Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and right on schedule, March is coming in like a lion in Hawaii. The forecast for Hilo, Hawaii today is rain and 78 degrees. The forecast for Central Park on my weather app is rain and 72 degrees. On March 1st, continuing our winter without winter. And recently we heard the stats that 2016 was the warmest year on record for the Earth as a whole, the third year in a row that the Earth set that record. Happy March from Hawaii on the Hudson. To mark the occasion, and with climate policy being dismissed as irrelevant in Washington now, I thought we might get a little refresher on the basic science of global warming for our general education, or maybe to use the next time you're at a party with our new EPA chief, Scott Pruitt. For this, we've called on Peter Domenical, Dean of Science at Columbia University and director of their new Center for Climate and Life, part of the Columbia University Earth Institute. At Columbia, as you sports fans know, every month comes in like a lion. So, Dr. Domenical, thanks for doing this, and welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me again, Brian. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Do you use the terms climate change and global warming interchangeably?
I do in loose conversation, but really what we're talking about now is climate change in very specific terms about how it impacts people. I think that's the most effective way to talk about it because no one lives the mean annual temperature of the planet, which is increasing.
Well, what's the curve of warming that leads scientists to believe it's a man-made phenomenon rather than a natural cycle?
Right. That's a great question. And so we've been measuring the temperature of the Earth for about 150 years. And that thermometer record, which is based on tens of thousands of measurements over time, shows that there's this steady increase in temperatures that's occurred, especially over our lifetimes in just the most recent decades. And the essential point is that 16 of the last 17 years of this millennium, or this century rather, have been the warmest ever measured in that entire instrumental record.
How much warming has actually taken place so far compared to, say, 1950?
Right, so it's a little bit, it's about a degree of centigrade of warming, and relative to what we call the pre-industrial baseline, it's about a degree 0.2 centigrade.
And how evenly is that warming distributed around the globe, is it?
Right, so that's a great question, and when Senator Inhofe brought a snowball to the Senate floor, it's important to separate weather from climate. Weather is what you get, and climate is what you expect. So, we do see this increase in temperatures, but it is distributed differently around the planet, and we especially see accelerated warming at the poles.
What are the most obvious effects of global warming to date that have a real impact on humans or other species?
Right. So the surface temperature, that curve that we've all seen, one could argue, and I think it's a point well taken, that no one really lives that temperature. What we live are the extremes. And to be sure, our experience of the extremes has increased, both in terms of the number of heat waves relative to cold temperatures. In fact, for February, that ratio of record warm versus record cold was 100 to 1. So this just gives you an idea of just how extreme things can be, but also in the damages that come from extremes, such as flooding and hurricanes that become more destructive. And if one doesn't want to believe the climate data, all you have to do is turn to the insurance and reinsurance industry, and there's a very easy plot that can be shown there. But, of course, the impact on crops, crop yields decrease by 5 to 10% due to these heat waves that come through. Something that's probably not common to or not well known to many of your listeners is that we quietly announced that the rate of sea level rise increased by a factor of 2 in just the last decade relative to the last century.
How variable are the models for how much further the world might change from now to the rest of this century?
Right. So the model projections extending now and into the decades ahead have a great agreement with the observations. So if we just look at the last 30 or 40 years, the models match the observations, but there's quite a bit of variability on that. But what we do see for the decades ahead is an acceleration of the warming trend that we've experienced already. So for those who are old enough to know what it was like earlier in their lives relative to what it's like now, and they can feel that difference, that phenomenon of noticing the warming temperatures in the greater extremes will accelerate into the future. And the models have a great deal of agreement. That is not to say the models are perfect. It's not to say that our crystal ball of the future is absolutely clear. There's a lot of questions to remain, but there's no debate on the direction of the change. That is, things are getting warmer and more extreme and more variable.
On this March 1st, headed for about 70 degrees in the New York area, we're doing Global Warming 101 with Peter Domenical, Dean of Science at Columbia University and director of their new Center for Climate and Life, part of the Columbia University Earth Institute, part of the winter without winter that we've been having, and a 70-degree March 1st coming this afternoon, we're told. So why do people believe this could be catastrophic? You talked about 1 degree of warming so far on average. It's more than 10 degrees warmer on average in Florida, for example, than it is here, and people live there just fine, except when they try to vote, but that's another show. So why is this 1 or 2 degrees a big deal?
So the 1 or 2 degrees is a big deal because actually what separated us from the last ice age was just about 5 degrees of centigrade for the global mean temperature. So it's really important to separate the temperature weirdness that you get in a given zip code versus the temperature weirdness you get for an entire planet. And so when you're talking about warming the entire planet, it's, you know, a planet that's also covered by 70% ocean, so you're warming the oceans as well. And so, you know, what's catastrophic about a degree of warming is that we believe the threshold for a temperature warming threshold beyond which we don't want to exceed. The reason why there exists a threshold is that's the temperature at which we believe there's runaway melting of ice sheets, whereby rising sea levels destabilize ice sheets even more, so they melt even more. And so you get this accelerated, what we call a nonlinear feedback.
There's a news story today that Warren Buffett said his insurance company, Berkshire Hathaway, has not figured a global warming premium into their insurance policies generally because, despite Hurricane Sandy and other events, the evidence of heightened systematic risk for whoever it is they insure has just not been there yet. Are they looking in the wrong place?
No, I think we have a number of systems. For example, the U.S. taxpayers are, you know, covering the expense of the coastal flood insurance that allows people to keep on rebuilding houses in areas that get destroyed by hurricanes and severe flooding. And so, if you were to imagine that socialized cost disappearing, even in the current administration, a lot of the incentive that goes into rebuilding on these locations would disappear, and there'd be a managed and thoughtful building plan along the coastline. So the global insurance companies, the global reinsurance companies, are very interested in climate change. In fact, they were the first adopters of bringing scientists into their fold to help them develop better actuarial models for their loss profiles as it relates to weather and climate change patterns.
I've read that carbon emissions are actually at a 25-year low right now, that they've been going down in recent years due to factors including natural gas replacing coal and oil in the marketplace quite a bit and from the Great Recession. Are carbon emissions, I guess, from this country really at a 25-year low?
They're not at a 25-year low, but they are decreasing. And in fact, actually, this is, you know, it's important not to always be Dr. Doom and Gloom on this. You know, it's important to see where there is a silver lining, where there is real change going on. And this is one of the areas. I mean, you can look at the world's largest economies, including the United States, and if you look at the last century or so, there's a perfect correlation or near perfect correlation between carbon emissions per capita, you know, over a year, versus GDP growth. And that relationship became decoupled. In other words, that correlation fell apart in about the last 3 or 4 years. And that's true for many EU countries and other countries as well. And that's signaling basically that the introduction of renewable energy sources, the introduction of cleaner fossil fuel sources such as natural gas, are having a very real impact that allow us to still have the same level of economic growth but with a much lower carbon footprint. And that's something we've known for a long time. And this is all happening without a price on carbon.
If that's the case, and this has been going on for years now, why do we keep having the warmest year on record year after year?
Boy, that's a great question. So the reason why we're warming, and in fact, even if we were to shut off the taps on carbon dioxide to the atmosphere now, the Earth would still continue to warm. And that's because there's heating that's kind of baked into the system by our historical carbon emissions. So the heating that we're experiencing now, the anomalous warmth that we're feeling now, is not the result of carbon emissions today. It's the carbon emissions that have accumulated in the atmosphere over the decades and even centuries into the past. And so there's this, it's a little like a credit card debt. You know, it's something that comes up and bites you in the end, and that's sort of what's happening now.
This is a Science 101 segment, but let me throw in a little bit of politics. President Trump has said he accepts that something is happening with the climate, but also that there was a scandal involving scientists puffing the data, which, of course, got a lot of press. How bad was that scandal?
Well, the scandal doesn't exist. This never happened in terms of scientists puffing up the data or scientists modifying the data. And you know, if someone wants to check that independently, there's a group called BEST, B-E-S-T. It's the Berkeley Earth Surface Temperature Team. And they were funded, actually, by the Koch brothers, in part, to do a complete reanalysis of all the temperature data, independent, involving none of the government agencies or none of the other university agencies that have been impugned in this. Dredging that happened. And that group came out with a very spectacular conclusion that the global temperature curve that they produced independently with their own, what they call A-plus team, exactly matched to within the hundredth of the degree area the temperature record that had been put together by the United States, by NASA, and by European agencies as well. And so, you know, I would challenge that claim vigorously that there's been any, modification or altering of climate data to get this agenda. And, you know, it's something that can be discounted, but we waste our breath talking about it because everyone knows that climate is changing. It's not something to be debated. We can argue about what the impacts are, but climate is absolutely changing. And even, you know, the greatest skeptics can look at it and say, yeah, okay, that's unusual.
And a skeptic might say 97% of scientists agree, that's the stat we always hear, that man-made global warming is real, but 97% of scientists once thought the Earth was flat and that carbs didn't cause heart disease. So how do you guard against people dismissing all of science with references from history like those?
Right. So, one of the things that's, I think, important to keep in mind is that, the temperatures that we see, we can actually have, we can actually measure the surface of the Earth and see just how unusual it is. And so this idea of consensus also gives some people a very uncomfortable feeling that there's this gang of people who are all agreeing that something's happening. The reality is that, 99.999% of people agree that gravity is what keeps their feet on the ground. And if some 0.001% of the person says no, it's because of some other, space aliens in the center of the Earth, do you take that notion seriously? And no, we don't. Why don't we? Because experience tells us so. And we have an understanding for how gravity works, and it explains many things, including satellites and other things. Climate change has that same authenticity and that same weft and weave of fundamental observations combined with basic science to explain the phenomena that we observe.
Well, we thought with weeks of unseasonably warm temperatures now, and here a forecast of 70 degrees this afternoon on March 1st, which is supposed to come in like a lion, and all of this intersecting with the change of administration in Washington and a big downgrading of global warming policy, we thought it was a good time for a little refresher course on the basic science of global warming. And for that, we thank Peter Domenical, Dean of Science at Columbia University and director of their new Center for Climate and Life, part of the Columbia University Earth Institute. So interesting. Thank you very much. I know people learned a lot.
Thank you very much, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Last month at a campaign rally in Florida, I should say at a post-election rally in Florida, sounded like a campaign rally, Donald Trump said he's not the only president in history who has battled it out with the press.
Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, and Abraham Lincoln, and many of our greatest presidents fought with the media and called them out oftentimes on their lies.
So that inspired us to do a little bit of historical fact-checking. Did Lincoln fight with the media? Did he call them out about lying to the public? Did he call them the enemy of the people? Here with me to help sort that out is Lincoln scholar, director of Hunter College's Roosevelt House Public Policy Institute, and author of the 2014 book Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion, historian Harold Hoser. Welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here, Brian. Thank you.
So I want to start with that quote from Trump, since we've been talking so much about Trump versus the media, and I've been saying it feels different and more heightened than any time in my lifetime right now. But maybe I'm wrong in the big sweep of American history. Are we just watching history repeat itself?
Well, we're watching something repeat itself, digestively maybe. It's not quite the same thing. Of course, Lincoln was more hostile and repressive when it came to the press, but it was a completely different circumstance, both in press culture and in the condition of the country. For one thing, every newspaper in America when Lincoln became president was either a Democratic or a Republican paper, outright, proudly carrying the party line, never varying from the party line. So everything a Democratic paper said about Lincoln was hostile. Everything a Republican paper said about Lincoln was praiseworthy.
Were there pro-slavery newspapers and anti-slavery newspapers? Did it break down like that at all?
Well, the Southern Democratic papers were inherently pro-slavery. Most of the Northern ones were anti-slavery expansion. Only a fringe were radically, in quotes, abolitionist at that time, because it was still a fringe movement at the outbreak of the Civil War. But the other difference in the culture is that there was, President Trump says we're in a terrible mess. Lincoln really had a terrible mess in that he had a rebellion on his hands. Talk about an existential threat to the country and a collapsing country.
Really?
And dealing with the dissolution of the Union and invoking the constitutional provision that the privileges of the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended in the event of an act of rebellion. So that gave him unprecedented power. So with all that as context, the bottom line is, yeah, he was more critical of the press. In fact, after the Battle of Bull Run in July 1861, which the Union was expected to sweep and then end the rebellion, after the Union lost, Lincoln ran out of volunteers. He had called up 75,000 troops for 3 months. The 3 months were over. He needed to call up another 100,000 plus soldiers if the rebellion was to be squashed. And there were Democratic papers who said, don't volunteer. Mm. And Lincoln and he kept his hands off of it. But the administration, they did some things that are infamous in history, especially if you're a straightforward Bill of Rights person. And let's just take New York, because we're broadcasting from New York. A grand jury said 14 papers should be shut down. The indictment never came, but they recommended them by name. The State Department shut down the New York Daily News. That's not the same, but I love saying the New York Daily News. Mm-hmm. Not the same Daily News. The Brooklyn Eagle. Pro-slavery, outright racist papers were shut down. They were banned from the post office, so they couldn't be mailed to Southern subscribers. They were thrown off trains bound south.
By the government?
Yeah. State Department, Interior Department, Post Office Department. And this happened all over the country. General Grant wrote proudly in, from his first command, I've confiscated the printing press. I've thrown the editor in prison. We had a fort right near Fort Schuyler, which still exists in Brooklyn Harbor, called Fort Hamilton. And it was called the Bastille of the North. Fort Lafayette. I knew I was wrong, but Hamilton is on everyone's mind. Fort Lafayette. Editors were thrown into Fort Lafayette. They languished there without formal charges being brought against them. Again, so Lincoln was more critical of critical press than Donald Trump, but the crisis was real and the circumstances were different.
What made it stop?
The repression?
Mm-hmm.
Did I mention that it stopped? In the Lincoln era, it was going on up until a couple of months before he died, and that was after the war was almost won. So in 1864, here in New York, right before the presidential reelection campaign got underway, the leading Democratic paper in New York, the New York World, which some of our listeners may remember became the World Telegram and Sun ultimately when all the papers merged, the New York World published a bogus presidential proclamation calling for 500,000 more volunteers.
Fake news.
Original fake news. And it came in the form of a dispatch from a wire service, not the AP. So most of the newspapers who got it at 1 in the morning regarded it with suspicion. And they checked with their Washington sources. They couldn't get it confirmed. The New York World, a Democratic paper, because the proclamation included a statement by Lincoln allegedly saying, oh, the war has been going terribly, they published it. Lincoln then signed his only direct order shutting down a newspaper and confiscating printing presses. And he had the newspaper man arrested. He was detained by General John Dix, who later became the namesake for a fort. And only after a couple of days did they realize that it was a sort of a harmless scam by a New York Times guy. He had left the New York Times, but he had devised a plot to put out this false news, fake news. The stock market would plummet. He would buy up some stocks, and then they would reveal this to be false. The market, and he was thrown in prison.
Wow. And when you talk about fake news today, and I'm not talking about, you know, the way Donald Trump inaccurately uses the term fake news to apply to any New York Times story or CNN story that he doesn't like the angle of, but the real Russian fake news, those kids, they're doing it for money. They're doing it because people buy Google ad adjacencies and things like that. So it's fake news for a profit, and you're telling me it was in Lincoln's day too.
At least on this one occasion, it wasn't politically motivated. It was for a profit, and the guy who was a friend of Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was a pretty famous New Yorker at the time, and he actually petitioned Lincoln to get the boy out of prison, and he was finally released.
The anti-Lincoln press was really harsh, something that most Americans, unless they're studying, you know, Lincoln history, don't get exposed to. For example, a Chicago reporter described the Gettysburg Address, as a string of silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances that would make the cheek of every American tingle with shame. Really?
Is that the Chicago Times?
I have it here as a Chicago paper. I didn't write down which one.
And guess what had befallen the editor of the Chicago Times a few months before the Gettysburg Address? He had been arrested, his printing presses shut down, and he had been imprisoned for criticizing the arrest of a former congressman in Ohio. The guy had reason to be angry. And, you know, that's an interesting thing. Fake response, fake analysis. You know, you turn on analyses on different radio stations or TV networks today, and you get a completely different take on a presidential utterance. When the Gettysburg Address was uttered, it was seen as very political. So the Republican papers, and this flies in the face of the myth that it was a failure at the time. It wasn't. The Republican press said it was a masterpiece. The Democratic press said it was embarrassing because they realized this guy was getting ready to run for a second term.
We're talking history. We proudly talk history here on The Brian Lehrer Show. And we're doing it now with the Lincoln scholar, Harold Holzer from Hunter College. He is the author of the book, among many others, called Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion, so relevant with what we see going on in the country today. Lincoln actually owned a newspaper at one point, didn't he?
He invested in and came to the rescue of a German language newspaper, and he signed – lawyers are not supposed to be their own clients, as we know. He created a contract where he would give the publisher $500, a lot of money in 1859, to get his newspaper press out of hock, and all the guy had to agree to do was not to print a word that was contrary to the Republican state and national platforms for 1 year, meaning the day after election 1860 when Lincoln was going to be. He assumed anyone who thinks he didn't think he was going to be a presidential candidate should look at the contract. And the odd thing is that, you know, Lincoln had no knowledge of German and was relying on friends to keep him apprised of what the Staatsanzeiger was going to be writing. And at the end of the period – so here's how the press worked in 1860. He gave he ripped up the contract or, you know, endorsed it over to the editor, whose name was Theodore Canisius. And then he had the state legislature buy up all the extant copies – for no particular reason except that got the guy about $500 or $600 more money, as a result of which, sadly, there's not one copy surviving of that paper. And then he made him – he gave him a diplomatic post in Vienna. And lots of newspaper men who were loyal to Lincoln got jobs in the administration.
If we think he was so clean and pure in every way.
He was a politician above all.
But some of the stuff that was written against him – so racially charged. From your book, The New York World published a 90-page tract, Miscegenation, the Theory of the Blending of the Races, that claimed that if Lincoln were reelected, he would ruin the nation by making blacks socially equal to whites and encouraging interracial marriage, and that caused a stir.
That was an original dirty trick long before Richard Nixon. I mean, nothing is new, right? The editor sent it to Lincoln and asked for an endorsement, a blurb, thinking he – just read that it's about everyone getting along, and he'd say people should read this book. They had duped a few anti-slavery people. Lincoln just put it in his drawer. He knew that it was bizarre. And it was a tongue-in-cheek advocacy of intermarriage because it was considered a radical notion then. But the New York campaign against him was brutal. And again, it was masterminded by the newspaper whose editor he had imprisoned.
Were the courts on the side of the press? Did they even take First Amendment claims to court at that time?
No, because they never produced the body. There was no habeas corpus. So they would be arrested by the military, these editors. They would be put into military prisons. Their cases would never be called. If they swore a loyalty oath to the Union after some hard time, and there are some great descriptions of editors, you know, eating maggot-filled meat on, you know, tablecloths made out of someone's long johns, pretty repulsive stuff. Then they would be freed if they signed the loyalty and oath and promise never to write anything disobliging. So the, you know, the dividing line, how do you define the loyal opposition versus treason, a dissent versus treason? And that's the fine line that editors who truly had a legitimate gripe had to walk.
During wartime, in that case.
During rebellion time. And, of course, we saw it again in wartime with Wilson and you know, he cracked down on some dissenting press as well, but nothing like Lincoln. Lincoln is still the world's champion in this regard.
Do you think that the press now is becoming more of what it was like back in the 1860s, more politically identified news outlets? We're almost going, you know, modern technology is taking us back in time.
I think it's too fractured to compare it today. I mean, I think you can make a case up until the 2016 campaign that there was a parallel between, let's say, Fox/MSNBC and, you know, 1860s New York when it was the New York Times versus the New York World, or the New York Times and New York Tribune as progressive Republican papers versus the New York World. But there are so many outlets now, and it's so scattered, and their origins are so mysterious. That was the point in the Lincoln era. These were agents of the Democratic Party. They were part of the political machinery. And people – by the way, with all this fractiousness and with all of this pent-up anger and the vitriolic quotes that you've cited a few of today, there was 80% participation by eligible voters in presidential elections. So maybe honest vitriol without condemning it all as fake is what will stir people to participate more.
Is there any other lesson before you go for the press and you know, defending the First Amendment at a time when the president is calling the press the enemy of the people, other than to look back on history and say it was worse than we think it was?
I would say the lesson here is be very, very careful about citing Abraham Lincoln as your exemplar and your inspiration. First of all, it's very dangerous. It's presumptuous. We heard a quote last night about the tariff, which is not quite Abraham Lincoln, by the way, from President Trump. He quoted somebody else quoting Abraham Lincoln, and to compare the modern economy to 1848 America, which had no tax levies except tariffs, is, you know, just using history through the wrong end of a telescope. And I noticed that no one today in sort of the fact-checking stories pushed back at that.
No one called him out on that particular one.
No.
Like calling him out on comparing himself to Abraham Lincoln.
I knew Abraham Lincoln, and he's no Abraham Lincoln.
Harold Holzer is a real Harold Holzer. He is the Fanton Director of Hunter College's Roosevelt House Public Policy Institute, an Abraham Lincoln scholar and author of books including Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion. Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we'll do a call-in on the question, how do you instill political values in your children while still encouraging them to think for themselves? Parents, call us up and talk about how you walk that line. This is our on-air number, not our pledge line, 212-433-WNYC. We're never going to ask you for money on the air when we're having a conversation. 212-433-9692. And this comes up because we posted this question on the Brian Lehrer Show Facebook page about bringing your kids to the recent protest marches, like the Women's March, or to the airports when the travel ban started. And it sparked a discussion with dozens of comments that centered on whether it is fair to bring children to marches or protests that align with your political beliefs. And in retrospect, maybe fair wasn't even the right choice of words, but in this era of heightened political awareness and participation, we've been thinking about the balance between parents instilling in our children the political values that we consider important while still giving our kids the intellectual space and encouragement to form their own political opinions. Who remembers the popular political button, Question Authority? I always thought parents wanted a version of that button that says, question authority, except your parents. So listeners, how do you instill political values in your children while encouraging them to think for themselves? Parents, call us up. Tell us how you walk the line. Share this thought with other parents out there at 212-433-WNYC. And if you've been participating in political marches or protests, when do you think it's a good idea? At what age? And with what context to bring your kids with you to the marches? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And here with me now to help explore the question and help take your phone calls, we are so delighted to have Andrew Solomon back with us, the renowned professor of psychology at Columbia, the president of PEN America, and the National Book Award-winning author of many books, including Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, very relevant to this, and Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
What a pleasure to be here with you again.
Do you have a general answer to the question for yourself?
There's a complex calculus, I think, between the part of national politics that has to do with endorsing a particular party and its complex platforms and an underlying sense of what is morally right. And I feel as though in the extreme factionalization that has taken place, I at least believe that the political discourse now is not only a discourse around politics, but a discourse between good and evil. And that saying to your children, the value of being inclusive, the value of drawing in people who are diverse and who are different, the value of protecting the rights of all people, the value of keeping committed to a society which contains a broad range of experience and ensuring that the have-nots are not made poorer while the people who have get wealthier, seems to me to be a question of basic morality rather than a question simply of partisan politics.
Which
there
means,
are also partisan questions, but those are the underlying ones.
Yeah, which means if you think we're in an existential moment where basic good or evil are on the line, then the question of encouraging your kids to think for themselves takes a back seat.
Well, I think you have to encourage your kids to think for themselves, but you're encouraging them to think for themselves about profound moral questions rather than saying to them that they have to make up their mind who they would vote for city council. Mm-hmm.
Camille in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. We love your show.
Thank you.
Our family listens to it every morning. So we had a situation. So both my husband and I are activists and advocates in New York, and I was working on the presidential campaign for Hillary for a couple of months. And when Trump was elected, we were in a situation where we had to explain to our children, like many Americans, about the situation. And it didn't hit very hard about what we were doing. We've also been attending a lot of the protests and taking our children, and they've been making signs. And it didn't really realize the effect it was having until we went to skiing this weekend for the February break. And we were upstate New York, and there was a number of kids who had Trump Pence T-shirts on. And we were on the line to go to the tubing, and our middle daughter turned around and looked at me, and kind of you could see that she was extremely uncomfortable. And, you know, they're biracial children, and, you know, it was a very kind of eye-opening that she automatically thought that the person that was wearing this T-shirt was racist and was, in fact, against all the values that we hold dear in our household and, you know, in our home. And so, you know, we took a break and sat down, but it was also an eye-opening for John and I, where we had to basically say, look, you know, just because somebody has different opinions doesn't make them a bad person. We can't assume the worst with different ideas. It's, you know, we need to teach you those values, but you also have to understand that, you know, just because someone is wearing a shirt or someone feels, you know, unless they're saying, oh, wearing something that's really overtly against kind of who you are, we can't also assume that there's very different reasons that people support things, and that as long as you stay true to your values and what you believe, that that's the most important thing. But it really made us rethink about how we're going to be talking about this in our home.
Yeah, it sounds like going skiing got you out of your bubble.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what it was.
Andrew, you want to talk to Camille?
Yeah, my son is 7, and he came home from school a couple of days after the election and said, Donald Trump is president, it's all the fault of, and he named the three children in his class whose parents had been Trump supporters. And I said, okay, in the first place, it is not the fault of these children, not even the fault of their parents. But I agree with you. We have to actually talk about complexity, and we have to talk about nuance. So having said that, I think there were very profound moral questions around the political divide of the last election, I nonetheless think you have to say to people, you cannot make any blanket assumptions. You can't make blanket assumptions about Trump supporters having such a dark point of view, or indeed about Hillary supporters necessarily being such wonderful people. You have to deal with complexity.
It's the next level of complexity, indeed, though, to say, as you said before, that we're in an existential moment of, you know, in a battle between good and evil, and to say that the kid you're playing with on the playground who supports the other side is an evil.
Exactly. I mean, I would also add, you know, my husband is a very strong activist in the city of New York, and so are we. And his mother, who is from Utah, who's Mormon, voted for Trump. And it was really difficult for us because this is an amazing woman who I look as my mother. And, you know, her views are not racist. She's a Samoan immigrant who came to this country. So we can't have blanketed views on this. We have to be open and have to talk to our children about the complexities of it all.
Camille, thank you so much for your call. What were you going to add, Andrew?
I was going to say that I think one responsibility of parenthood is to change your children. Not changing your children constitutes neglect. And the changing of your children involves giving them, among other things, a sense of moral values and a compass with which to navigate the world. But you also need to accept your children and ultimately allow them to make their own decisions. And the line between what you change and what you accept can be a very blurry line. And in this question, the issue of how much are you teaching them to understand the world through a moral lens, and how much are you cramming your own ideology down their throat? It's sometimes difficult to know which of those things you're doing.
Kristen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Kristen, thanks so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. So, you know, I speak to my children all the time about politics. I mean, even after this morning, we were talking about Jefferson and, you know, how, you know, the things that he did and what he didn't do. But I try to get them to have a broader understanding of you know, what is being said, what is being done, and it impacts on us personally as a family and on us as a country. And try to, you know, have them form their own opinions based on those things. I mean, I provide my opinion as well, but, you know, what I'm trying to get them to do is just to think about, you know, are these things, you know, right? Are these things wrong? How do these things impact, you know, everyone?
Can you give me an example with you and your kids? Or let me ask you another way. What happens when you feel really strongly about something?
Well, I guess what happens when I feel strongly? I mean, I express my opinion. I tell them how I feel. But, you know, I also let them know, well, you know, not everyone is going to have your same opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way that we might feel about, you know, the election or about, you know, some sort of policy might be right for us, but it may be, you know, there may be people with other points of view that have, you know, strong opinions on their side as well.
Kriston, thank you very, very much. Alexis in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Brian. So my son Jack is 11, and he's come in to vote for me during both presidential, I guess it's three presidential
elections. To vote with you? You mean he goes to the polling place with you?
Yes, he comes to the polling place, and then he comes into behind the curtains, and I let him press the button.
Mm-hmm.
So he loves that. And, you know, we talk about politics in the House. He does listen to your, well, not your show, he's in school, but he does listen to NPR. And we have conversations, and we do have friends that participate in the political process. But last night while watching Rachel Maddow, and she was making the connections between President Trump and Russia, Jack turned to me and said, you know what, Mom, forget it. He goes, they're all crooks. And I felt so bad. I'm like, Jack, no. He said, even Bernie Sanders, Mom. I said, no, Jack, you must keep hope. So I felt really bad. Like,
wow.
This whole thing has really tainted him.
It's made him cynical at 11 years old. So Andrew Solomon, here's yet another wrinkle. If you're teaching your children the difference between, you know, if you're teaching values on the one hand, but then teaching them kind of hard political analysis on the other hand, then somehow you have to put up a bulwark against cynicism.
Well, I mean, George came home one day and said, before the election, he said, if Donald Trump is elected president, I don't plan to obey him. And I said, you know, if Donald Trump is elected president, we will have a big political process and there'll be some aspects of it that we'll need to obey. And I said, and he'll do some good things. I said, he won't do only terrible things. I think, again, it's a question of giving your child a sense of nuance, but trying to avoid getting your child into a place of complete cynicism, which you do partly by instilling a sense of your child's own enfranchisement. If you see things that are wrong with the world, you may ultimately have the power to change them. I think the view of darkness has to be conceived as a path toward ultimately building a better world and not toward just thinking it's all hell, it's all ridiculous, they're all ludicrous, and giving up on political process.
Kriston in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kriston.
Hi. I was just calling to say I have two daughters, and I am the lone Democrat in my family, so I couldn't frame any political discussion as an us versus them discussion because they're our family and we love them. So I try to describe it as we believe government can help people, and they and my extended family has a different belief that government's too big. So that's how I kind of describe the political situation to my girls.
And, Andrew, you want to talk to Kriston? And it's different when the kids are this young, 6 and 3, than, say, our
right.
last caller, whose son is 11, right? Maybe you can use your knowledge of developmental psychology to parse the difference here.
Well, I would say that very young children tend to want a very high level of certainty, and that it's often difficult to make complex, nuanced arguments with small children. They want to know what's right and what's wrong. You know, do we get in trouble for doing this? Do we get rewards for doing that? That's why all of those systems with very young children come into play. They then make a transition to wanting to understand what the world is really like and to recognizing that very few things are entirely right or entirely wrong. And part of one's responsibility as a parent is to be alert to what they are capable of, not to force young children who aren't capable of nuance into thinking in ways that are beyond them, but not to insist that older children conform to the simplicity that you have described to them. And you have to constantly be revising and saying effectively, I know we looked at it this way a year ago, but you're a little older now. What are the ways you can think about it now?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's very explicit. So you think Christine was kind of on the right track with a six-year-old and a three-year-old, kind of, you know, establishing that she believes in something, but there are people in the family who believe other things without confusing them?
I think establishing that and establishing, in addition, that they love one another makes an enormous difference. To say people think otherwise and we can still love them. And I think the moral compass has to do with accepting a diversity of opinions on a great many subjects. It doesn't have to do with forcing one point of view on people who don't share it.
Christine, thank you so much for bringing that up. Did you want to add something?
Thank you. I just wanted to say, like, one specific example that came up was always strapping them in and out of car seats, and they are complaining, like, oh, why do we have to do this? Oh, this is the worst. And I said, you know, it's funny. I'm like, when I was a kid, I'm like, we didn't even have to wear a seatbelt. And I'm like, and people got hurt because there was, you know, we weren't as strict with, like, car safety and children riding in vehicles. And that was like, an example that they could understand how things changed and how I felt like government overreach was actually good for people. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, I remember as a kid in the 80s, like, my dad would complain about, like, police officers giving tickets to people not wearing seatbelts. Like, it was a big part of my childhood. And, like, that's completely changed, yeah. I think. So, I don't know. That was just one example.
Good example.
It was more for my six-year-old than my three-year-old. So.
Christine, thank you so much. Andrew, we just have 30 seconds left, but let me ask you to touch on one last thing. We were looking at a Psychology Today article where the writer was on about how parents accidentally instill anxiety in their kids since the presidential election. That's a separate question from, you know, how do you walk the line between independent thinking and instilling your values? But accidentally, because so many people are so horrified, they are probably also communicating anxiety. Is that something you've thought about?
Our first job is to keep our children safe, and we have to be able to judge what they're capable of processing and what is going to generate troubling anxiety. Some degree of anxiety may be the very engine if they're bringing about the social change I described a moment ago and their sense of empowerment. But too much anxiety makes them afraid and unable to function. And there, I think we have to draw the line and say, bad things are happening, but we are going to be okay.
Andrew Solomon, professor of clinical psychology at Columbia, the president of Pan America, and the National Book Award-winning author of many books, including Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, and Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change. Judging from our listener response between you and the stories that some of the parent callers told, I think this has been so helpful for so many parents out there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.